From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Is global warming back on the global agenda? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Yesterday's People's Climate March crowded the streets of New York, and today the pioneer Rockefeller family announced divestment in fossil fuels. But major polluters, China, India, Russia, even Germany, won't even attend the climate summit at the United Nations tomorrow. Leaders are worried about the cost of controlling global emissions, despite reports that economies can gain from going green. President Obama put the U.S. in the forefront with new rules on power plants. Can he invest other heads of state with a sense of urgency? Today's talking point, a new terror threat you've never heard of. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney back with To the Point. Heads of state have been called to the UN tomorrow to discuss climate change, but the meeting's already been called the summit that snoozed. We'll hear who's coming and, more importantly, who's not. Can mass protest, the Rockefeller family, and President Obama turn the momentum around? Today's talking point, assessing the threat of terrorism against the U.S. is a complicated business. Intelligence officials have identified new groups which may pose more danger to the American homeland than ISIS, the Islamic State. First is news update. More than 130,000 Syrian Kurds fled from ISIS forces into Turkey over the weekend. Now Turkey has clamped down on border crossings. The U.S. and others are trying to determine which side Turkey is on. Joe Parkinson is Istanbul bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal. And Joe, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for inviting me.
The Turks have allowed more than 1 million Syrian refugees who are fleeing Bashar al-Assad's government in Syria. Is it making some kind of distinction between those and the new ones that are fleeing from ISIS?
Turkey certainly come under a lot of criticism in recent months for what some Western governments have called a sort of indiscriminate border policy. The southern area of Turkey has been labeled a jihadist highway by some commentators because they believe that the Turks have been allowing the free flow, or at least not being discriminating enough to stop the flow of foreign fighters reaching Syria and going to fight for groups like ISIS. What's happened over the past 4 days, really, is that ISIS has opened up a new front against a Kurdish town on the Turkish border. And the refugee flows coming in the other direction, coming across the Syrian, across the Turkish border, are huge. It's the you noted the 130,000 estimate. The estimates go up to 200,000, which the UN says would be one of the biggest human waves since the Syrian war began. Turkey would say they're not clamping down on the border. These refugees have been allowed to cross, but the situation's very complicated because some Kurds are moving in the other direction to go and fight on behalf of the Kurds, and because Turkey's come under so much criticism for having a porous border, they would say they're in a situation where they really can't win.
ISIS recently turned over the hostages that it had taken in Mosul, the Turkish hostels from the consulate there, to Turkey, returned them. Does there appear to have been any quid pro quo there? Might that have something to do with what's happening at the border?
I'm not sure if those two issues are linked. What we know about the prisoner release is that there's, well, we don't know that much. In fact, there's still many, many questions hanging over it. The government, President Erdogan yesterday, insisted that no ransom was paid. Previously, government officials had said there was no quid pro quo, but the president was a little bit less explicit when he was asked directly about whether there could have been a prisoner swap between ISIS and the Turkish government. He didn't deny that and said that some kind of diplomatic or political deal had been made and that it was the right decision for Turkey because they managed to extricate their hostages. You know, what this says about the relationship between Turkey and ISIS There's a lot of speculation about, as I said, Western governments have been a little bit upset by what they see as perhaps, you know, cozier relations than there should be, and Turkey not being a full-throated member of this US-led coalition to attack ISIS. You know, President Erdogan is now in the United States for the UN meeting, and he said that he will have, you know, consultations, and Turkey may now shift its strategy. He signaled that perhaps they'll take, you know, a more significant role in this coalition.
What about ISIS and Turkey and oil?
That's another imponderable, and it's certainly something which in the Western media for the past month, people have been writing stories about how the Turkish border is not just a facilitator of personnel for ISIS, but potentially financing. And that's because smuggling routes that predate this conflict have been exploited by ISIS and Turkish smugglers on the other side to, you know, enable oil that ISIS is refining to get to market. Now, actually, in the past 3 weeks, and U.S. officials would agree with this, the Turks have done a lot to clamp down on this oil trade to try and suffocate one of these financing lines to ISIS. They've raided some of these smuggling villages along the border. They've blocked some of the makeshift pipelines that were, allowing the flow of oil across the frontier. And that was one way that they could covertly attempt to try to block ISIS or sort of suffocate ISIS when they weren't able to do many overt things because they were so worried about the fate of their hostages.
Does it appear that Turkey is sort of trying to have it both ways and cope with ISIS as best it can at the same time that it tries to maintain its own independence from the West?
I think that's a fair characterization, and Turkey would say that that's perhaps the right position for them to take because they are uniquely exposed to this threat of ISIS. They would say it's all very well for Western capitals to criticize them, but this war and this kind of jihadist cancer, if you like, is not evolving along Western borders. It's right here in Turkey along a very, very porous 900-kilometer border that's very difficult to police. It's a very, very complicated situation in Turkey. Turkey has a huge Kurdish population. We're now seeing a fight between ISIS and the Kurds. Historically, Turkey has been at loggerheads with parts of its Kurdish population that were fighting against Ankara for more autonomy. Those same Kurds are represented in the Syrian area that's being attacked by ISIS now and flowing across the border. It just goes to underscore how confused and difficult from a policy point of view it is for Turkey.
Joe Parkinson in Istanbul for The Wall Street Journal. Many thanks to you. In a moment, is global warming back on the global agenda on To The Point.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're now back with To The Point. Hundreds of thousands of people flooded the streets of Manhattan yesterday to demand action from heads of state at tomorrow's climate summit at the United Nations. Today on Wall Street, protesters focused on the role of financial institutions. Frances Beinecke has been active on both of those days. She is president of the Natural Resources Defense Council and author of an upcoming book, The World We Create, A Message of Hope for a Planet in Peril. Frances Beinecke, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Tell us what happened on Wall Street today.
Well, on Wall Street, thousands demonstrated in front of Wall Street to call for a clean energy future and address climate change. And people were there and intended to get arrested if they needed to be to get their point across. And that's the second step of what was an unprecedented demonstration of 400,000 people yesterday on the streets of New York calling for action on climate change and climate justice across the world.
I understand nobody was arrested today, apparently the result of the fact that New York has a new mayor.
Well, I guess that's right, but they are prepared to be, and I think it's indicative of the intensity of feeling around this issue. We were joined on the streets of New York yesterday with people on the front lines of climate change across the country and across the world. There were people who suffered from Sandy in New York City, people from indigenous communities all over the world, and people who really see what the impacts are in their communities day to day, and they want a clean energy future, and they want the world leaders who are coming into New York City this week for a climate summit led by Ban Ki-moon to act on climate.
What exactly do they want the leaders to do at the summit?
What they want them to do is to make a commitment to address climate change, reduce their emissions across the world in their countries, and to ensure that we have a clean energy future so that our planet survives and so that the people are not on the front lines of climate change, which is happening increasingly from extreme weather events, sea level rise, drought, extreme storms all across the world.
Your forthcoming book talks about the role of activism of this kind in trying to affect change. Tell us a little bit more about how effective it's been in the past and how much more you anticipate in the future.
Well, I think what's really happening is that people are experiencing both the impacts of climate change and the impacts of fossil fuel development firsthand. Here in the United States, over 30 states are engaged in fracking. Oil is being moved around on oil trains that are going through communities all across the country. And people are experiencing what this continuing addiction to fossil fuels is doing to their homes, to their communities, to their health and well-being. That is moving people to call for a clean energy future and direct action on climate change. And I think yesterday's real outpouring in New York City, but across the world, there were literally thousands of events across the world calling for climate action and a clean energy future that really indicated that there is a moment now to get serious about this issue. And if we don't, the long-term consequences are going to be enormous. But the other thing I think that's really heartening is there are solutions to this issue. There are clean energy technologies, there is energy efficiency, and there is a pathway to address the problem of climate change. There has to be a will, and I think what people showed on the streets of New York yesterday is there's tremendous public support for that. And that will allow our leaders on the world level and on the United States level to act.
Tell us about the Rockefeller brothers, their history, family history with oil, and what they've done today.
So I just came from a press conference on divestment that was led by the Wallace Global Funds and Stephen Hintz, who's the, the president of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, announced their commitment to divest their $850 million endowment from fossil fuels. And he did speak about the origin of Standard Oil, that John D. Rockefeller created the oil economy in this country, and that in the 19th century, that moved us into an important economic benefit for the country. But now it's time to move into a new clean energy future. And he said that if John D. Rockefeller were here today, being innovative thinker of his time, he would be endorsing this too. And I think for the Rockefeller family and for their foundation to really recognize the future has to be different and to lead the way is just enormously significant.
Francis Beinecke, once again, the president of the Natural Resources Defense Council, very active, as we've heard, in the last couple of days and for many years in the issue of climate change. Alistair Doyle is environment correspondent for Thomson Reuters, and good to have you on our program.
Thanks a lot, Warren. Very nice of you to invite me.
Do you think that this activism will, in fact, have an impact on the climate summit? And tell us about the summit itself. It's only one day long, isn't that right?
That's right. It's just one day. And this is the first time this has happened since 2009, which was the last time when the world had a big push to agree a climate treaty. That ended in failure in Copenhagen at a summit in December that year, when world leaders, including Barack Obama, turned up but didn't strike a deal that would actually firmly stop the rise in greenhouse gas emissions. And since that time, global climate policy has been on kind of a back burner for everybody. You've had the financial crisis, you've had economic downturn. People have been more concerned about their jobs and their economies and about, you know, saving the polar bears and the future of the planet. But now things are turning back. This climate summit, as Francis was saying, is kind of an opportunity. I think it was a surprise. There were so many people who turned out yesterday onto the streets for many people. The organizers of the march in New York have been talking about hoping to beat the record from Copenhagen of when 100,000 people turned out in what was the biggest previous march. And some people were saying, well, you know, that's unlikely, or let's see it. But in fact, you know, there were 300,000 or 400,000 people in the streets yesterday in New York, which is an astonishing turnout on an issue like this. So, yeah, it's just one day. But I suppose it is a chance for the world to sort of to try and take stock of this. It's there is an agreement that the by almost 200 nations that they'll come up with an agreement by the end of next year, a new, not necessarily a treaty, but some sort of agreement on climate change at a summit in Paris next year. So times, minds are beginning to focus a bit on that deadline, I suppose. So even though it's a day, you know, it is an opportunity now, I suppose, for Ban Ki-moon to say, look, you know, the world is, we're not just talking about combating Islamic State. We're not just talking about the problems in Syria or Ebola or Ukraine. It's a chance to put climate back on the agenda a bit.
And yet, at the summit, we won't see the leaders of China or Russia or Germany or India or Canada. Why not?
That's right. I think they all have their own, you know, they have their own excuses, but it is strange that they're all staying away from this one event. They all have their own excuses for this, the United Nations try to say, well, it's not so important who turns up, it's what they say that matters. But it's very difficult to imagine that the Vice Premier of China, Zhang Jiuli, will come up with an amazing announcement tomorrow. At the last climate summit of this sort at the United Nations in 2009, the previous president, Hu Jintao, announced for the very first time that China would restrict the growth of its emissions. And that was the story from that summit in 2009. And that was an amazing change for China, which previously has said, you know, we need to be allowed to allow our emissions to grow pretty much as fast as they can because, you know, Western countries have had the benefit of 200 years of industrialization when they've grown their economies by burning fossil fuels, and we need to catch up. So now, you know, that acknowledgement in 2009 that China would limit the growth of its emissions, at least, without setting a firm cap, was a big moment. And by not having the Chinese president here, I don't think an announcement of that scale is likely at all.
Let me go back to Francis Beinecke with the Natural Resources Defense Council. We understand the arguments made by China and also by India that they need a chance to catch up. That's the argument they often use for not getting involved in these things. But what about not just Russia, but Canada and Germany? Why do you suppose they're not there?
Well, I don't know why they're not there. Clearly, under the current leadership of Canada, there's a lot of attention on fossil fuel development, particularly tar sands, which has to change in order to address the very serious problem of climate change. I think the one thing that'll happen at the summit that'll really be important is there'll be a lot of announcements from countries and from companies and a lot of interested parties on what is actually happening now to address climate change. And our hope is that that assembly of examples of solutions will create the momentum that's needed to go into Paris 2015. The countries have to come up with targets in the first quarter of 2015 to meet that December goal. And, you know, tomorrow's conversation, I think, will be, even without those major players, will be very important in showing that a lot of steps are being taken at all levels of government, in cities, in states, in companies that really are showing how to reduce emissions, how to create clean energy futures. And it's that assembly which we hope will motivate the leaders to the next stage. Also, one other thing, both China and India are making commitments to address, actually move clean energy forward. And whether they're here or not, there's a lot of work going on in those countries to create a strategy going forward. China's announced an effort to have a cap on coal, which is their largest single energy source, and that's an important step. India has a solar mission where they are ramping up their investment in renewables. So there are still many, many things happening, even if they're not present in New York, and there has to be a lot of attention to get the kinds of commitments we will need in Paris 2015 to really address the serious problem of climate change.
Let me introduce Michael Jacobs. He's senior advisor to the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate that is headed by the former president of Mexico, Felipe Calderon. A key author of the commission's new climate economy is Michael Jacobs, and thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Very nice to be here.
The report has been advertised as indicating that it may well be that instead of costing economies, reduction of carbon emissions might in fact be good for economic growth. Tell us how you've managed to reach that conclusion.
The conclusion, as you say, which is that you can have both growth and a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions at the same time, arises because the world is changing. A few years ago, it was difficult to see how that could be true because all the ways of cutting emissions looked to be expensive. But now technological change and some of the structural changes that are occurring, particularly in the fast-growing developing countries, make it possible to get very strong economic performance with much reduced emissions. Renewable energy it gives us perhaps the clearest example of this. The costs of solar and wind power have dramatically fallen over the last few years, about 80 to 90% in the last decade, which means that it's now possible to put wind power and solar power onto the grid, even without subsidy in many countries, and the cost continues to fall. So the countries are now looking at very different energy choices, and at the same time as renewables have become cheaper, coal, which has been the major source of power for many countries for many years, is now becoming more expensive, both in its pure economic cost terms, but also in the air pollution that it generates. So if you look at a country like China and India, these are countries with severe air pollution problems that are causing civil rights problems because people are really angry about it, and those are all associated with fossil fuels. So for those countries, the renewable energy option looks like a much better option, and the coal energy choice looks like a worse choice. And in that way, the world is different now from what it was a few years ago, and that's the basis of our conclusion, one of them in the energy system, and there are others in other areas, which suggests that we can now get growth and reduced emissions at the same time.
What about the fact that solar and wind aren't all on all the time and are difficult to store, and the concern that if you try to replace the existing energy sources with solar and wind, that you'll have a lot of white elephants sitting around, and that will cost you?
Well, you can. Most countries are starting from quite a low base. So over the next 10 to 15 years, there's a huge amount of solar and wind that can go in before the problems of variability, as you quite rightly say, begin to take effect. And you can see this in California, of course, where both solar and wind have taken off over the last few years, and even in Texas, which now has tremendous wind resource that's now beginning to be exploited, as well as in other countries. So we've got a way to go before you get to the point where the system can't cope because it has to have electricity all the time, and wind and solar are variable. And in that time, in the next 10 to 15 years, I am pretty confident, and the technologies look as if now that they will be developed to improve storage so that we will be able to get those technologies stored. And the other thing we can do is we can manage the demand much better. So using information technology alongside new energy systems, we can manage demand so that demand is high when the wind and the solar are blowing and shining, as it were, and lower when they're not. And thirdly, we can connect our energy systems better so that many parts of the world can have systems where you can connect different energy sources into a single grid, which allows you to spread the loads at different times. So there are ways of making a renewable energy system something which is sustainable without a lot of fossil fuel backup, and that's what is beginning to happen. And if you look at so many countries around the world now, that is beginning to happen.
Michael Jacobs again, a senior advisor to the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate, headed by the former president of Mexico, Felipe Calderon, arguing that, in fact, going green can be good for the economy. We're going to take a very brief break. We'll come back. We'll continue with our conversation with Francis Beinecke and Alistair Doyle and Michael Jacobs. We'll also talk with Ethan Zindler at Bloomberg's New Energy Finance. We'll hear a bit more about President Obama and his role in the climate change summit. Later on, we'll talk on our talking point about a look at terrorist threats against America. We'll hear about a new one that you have never heard of before. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Jump into a new mode of music discovery with the KCRW Music Mine. It's our first iPad app dedicated entirely to music exploration. The Music Mine brings you an interactive experience with a constantly evolving galaxy of audio, video, and photos. Discover by artist, by DJ, or by song, and easily share the music you love with friends. The KCRW Music Mine. Dig into it on your iPad. More info at kcrw.com.
Well, we're not only back with To The Point, talking today about the climate summit for heads of state around the world, scheduled for tomorrow at the United Nations. It had been somewhat derided in advance as the summit that snoozed because a lot of important leaders aren't going to be there. And yet, there now has been an enormous demonstration in Wall Street and in New York City yesterday, 400,000 people on the streets, other demonstrations around the world. Some thought, particularly with the kind of report we just heard about from the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate, indications that maybe it is back on the global agenda after all. Ethan Zindler is head of policy analysis at Bloomberg New Energy Finance. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What about President Obama and his role recently in setting new standards for power plants in this country? How important is that, around the world, and what's his role tomorrow in the climate summit?
So the U.S.'s role is suddenly very important. And in fact, I would argue that to some large degree, these talks that they've been holding year in and year out have been, for the most part, relatively pointless in the sense that the U.S. could only make limited commitments about what it was going to do to address the problem. But the administration has now laid out two particular regulations, but one most recently addressing the U.S. Power sector and trying to reduce CO2 emissions from it. So I would argue that for the first time, the U.S. is showing up at one of these discussions with a serious card that it can actually play. And while tomorrow will not actually be a negotiation, it's more of a series of speeches, it is the prelude to two more sessions, one in December of this year and then culminating in December of 2015 in Paris, where it is hoped and expected that we'll reach some kind of pact.
Do you expect that President Obama will make a statement that will in some way shame those leaders who haven't showed up, the people from China and Germany and Russia and India and Canada?
I don't think so. I mean, I think to some degree other nations and their domestic politics are to some degree shielded. I don't think, for instance, if Obama hadn't showed up, that we would have felt embarrassed if the Indian president had called him out on it. So I'm fairly realistic about these things. But I do think that the fundamentals are there for the first time maybe ever for there actually to be some kind of an agreement next year, in the sense that both the U.S. and China are now making, one could argue, legitimate efforts to try and rein in CO2 emissions. Now, the reasons behind why they're doing that are complex, and frankly, I would argue that they don't necessarily have to do with saving the planet, and often they have to do more with domestic politics. But regardless, the direction of travel is generally the right one at the moment.
What's happening in this country in terms of energy consumption and in greenhouse gas emissions? Francis Beinecke at the Natural Resources Defense Council mentioned earlier that we're fracking all over the place in this country, and there's a lot of concern about that.
So it's interesting to note that actually U.S. overall emissions have more or less been flatlining over the last five years or so, although they creeped up a little bit last year. And one of the main reasons for that is we've seen coal going from accounting for about 48% of our power generation down to about 38%. And most of that has been replaced by natural gas, although renewables have also come on very strong. And so when you make that kind of a swap, you end up with a lower profile CO2 emission for the U.S. sector overall. The other thing is that actually the U.S. economy has been getting more energy efficient, which is very good news as well. Some of that is, frankly, and sadly, been driven by the offshoring of some manufacturing to other countries. But some of it has simply been by various companies trying to find ways to do business more efficiently to save costs.
Let me go back to Alistair Doyle, the environment correspondent for Thomson Reuters. Given the nature of climate change, how effective are the kinds of solutions that we're hearing about in actually turning it around? What degree or what portion of climate change is in fact are human activities really responsible for, and to what extent can we really anticipate a change that we can affect in the kinds of things that we hear going on about droughts and flooding and all of the various environmental manifestations we've seen of this?
The main panel of climate scientists of the United Nations said a year or so ago that it raised the probability that, in its view, that human activities are the main cause of climate change to 95%, the dominant cause since 1950 or so, from 90%, which was their judgment back in 2007, and 66, which was their judgment back in 2001. So the scientific consensus about this has been getting only stronger with the years. Now, public opinion lags this quite a lot. There aren't, when you ask people what's the main cause of climate change, normal people quite a lot of them say, well, it's probably natural variations in the climate. The scientists haven't done brilliantly in getting their message across that, they are almost rock solid behind saying that this is human emissions. Now, of course, from getting from the understanding that mankind's emissions are to blame to actually stopping those emissions is something completely different, of course. There was a study yesterday that showed that, China's emissions have been rocketing in the last years, and have now, China overtook the United States as the main source of greenhouse gases in 2006. By last year, China has now overtaken the United States and the European Union combined in its emissions. So its growth has been enormous. China is opening, coal-fired power plants at the same time as it's having this greater awareness of climate change and trying to shift to solar power. The drivers of China's emissions, I think, are going to be the key to solving this problem in many ways, to slowing down that rate. Now, it may just be that I think, in many countries, including China, that greater awareness of the health effects of climate change, that actually, power plants and fossil fuel emissions are actually causing people illnesses right here and now, rather than storing up some threat for the future for, children and grandchildren of people alive today. I think that awareness may help drive a lot of the action on climate change. It may be a shift in the policy to say, look, we're going to attack this mainly as a public health issue rather than a climate change issue.
Back to Michael Jacobs on that one. You mentioned earlier that China is concerned about pollution and that civil rights has been an issue there. But at the same time, they are building coal plants, even though they're also committed to renewables. So what's the balance?
Well, that is absolutely true. China is now building more solar and wind than any other country, but it is also still building coal. And that is because China's economy, which is incredibly large, is still growing very rapidly. So it has a huge energy demand and it's trying to meet it from all sources. So this is not easy, and nobody should think that this has been cracked just because the Chinese authorities now recognize the scale of the problem. But they do recognize the scale of the problem, and that is encouraging. And so, for example, the Chinese leadership is talking about capping first its coal production or coal use, not production, it's consumption of coal, and then capping its overall greenhouse gas emissions. And these were things which you couldn't have imagined them saying just a few years ago. So there is a much greater understanding in China, and that does then enable other countries to say, well, look, if China is doing it, then it's no longer an argument that you can make in the US, for example, that there's no point in us doing it in the US because no one else is doing it. In particular, China isn't doing it. That argument is not.
But if they're still building coal plants, isn't the cap then going to be somewhat higher than what they're doing at the moment?
The cap will be at around the level. If they introduce a cap, it'll be at around the level that they are producing, that they are using coal now. You have to remember that although they're building new coal plants, they're also shutting coal plants. Most of the reasons that the new coal plants are coming onto the system is because they're getting rid of the old, much more polluting ones that are causing the terrible pollution problems. So I'm not in any sense trying to be complacent about the issue here, but the problem of climate change is the expected growth in emissions, and China is now trying to cap its emissions and then bring them down over time. So while not, by, as I say, not in any sense saying, you know, the problem has been cracked, this does give the rest of the world, including the US, a chance to say, we should be doing this because other countries are also doing it. And that is really important, because so often you hear the argument, oh, there's no point in it happening here, there's no point in the US cutting emissions because China isn't doing it. Well, China is now doing it. And so I do think that changes the politics of this in the US and in many other countries too.
Francis Beinecke, back to you, President of the Natural Resources Defense Council, active both yesterday in New York and today on Wall Street. What about the fact that the United States is exporting coal to China and Australia, as well as fracking? How does that complicate the picture?
Well, I think it does complicate it, because I think that, in essence, we have to go to 100% clean energy. And the sooner we have a strategy that takes us off of fossil fuels, not only here in the United States, but not exporting our fossil fuels to other countries, is very, very important. And I think that's the whole issue of climate justice and getting 400,000 people on the streets to demand a clean energy future is an important part of that. I also think one of the things that is heartening, which Michael discussed, is there's a lot of clean energy development going on. There is still a lot of fossil fuel use, but it's increasing the amount of clean energy that's in the pipeline. And I think what all of us are looking to do is, how do we accelerate that movement towards cleaner technologies, towards a much more efficient energy system than we have now? And it's really the acceleration of technology and adoption towards cleaner strategies, which is pivotal to code into the conference tomorrow and the conference in Lima and Paris that's coming up in 2015. It's, how do we move everyone? And I just want to say, not only is it important for China to make commitments, because they are the largest producer of carbon emissions, and the United States, because we have such a historical contribution over time, but literally to address climate change, every single country, every single entity has to participate in it. This is not an issue where you could say, it's this person's fault, they have to do it, the others can wait it out. That really is not true. And I think with the ever more present consequences of climate change evident to people around the world, there's beginning to be much more of a we all have to participate framework to this conversation than there's been in the past.
Let me go back to Ethan Zindler, the head of policy analyst at Bloomberg New Energy Finance. You said earlier that the United States is playing a new role, that for the first time it has a card to play because of what the president has done with regard to power plants and with the emissions going down. And yet, from a political standpoint, this might not hold, because already in Senate races around the country, we are seeing not just Republicans, but Democrats saying that they're opposed to the new rules of the EPA, that they're actively supporting the idea of continuing to have a coal industry in this country. So how firm is the U.S.'s position in this new role?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, to some degree, this is going to be dictated actually by who becomes the next president of the United States, because while the regulation has been issued by the Obama administration, this Congress in the House of Representatives has already passed legislation to try to undo it. Now, the president has said he'll veto that, and he will, if it ever got to his desk. I don't think it'll even get through the Senate. And then next year's Congress may be even more inclined to pass such a bill. But again, we'll still have this president who, in my view, will almost certainly veto it. So then the question becomes, what happens? Where are we in 2017 with a new president and a new Congress? And are we going to see this same thing play out? And there is, of course, always the chance that a rule that's been written can be unwritten by Congress and signed into law by a new president. That is out there. But we're several steps away from that happening at this point.
Michael Jacobs, with the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate, are there other countries where this is as politically hot an issue, if that's the right term, as it is here in the United States?
There are only a small number of other countries where it's become an ideological issue in the way that it has in the U.S. So in the U.S., there is now a big divide between Democrats and Republicans on the basis of climate science, let alone the policy. The policy parts to this. That's only really true in Australia, and amongst other countries, a little bit in the United Kingdom, not very much, a little bit in Canada, but most countries around the world, this is not an issue of ideology. This is an issue properly of policy. And there are different policy choices that countries have to make, whether they go down a lower carbon or a higher carbon path, and different governments around the world are in different positions on that. But the core science is not really questioned anywhere, as I say, outside the US and one or two other places. The debate has moved on. And interestingly, for example, in Europe, the debate is really about how we can best build a low-carbon economy. Most parts of the European political system would accept that we need to move in that direction. There is some disagreement on the speed of it, what the best policy instruments are. But it doesn't have this very virulent ideological flavor that does in the US. And to be perfectly honest, in Europe, that is a very good thing because it means that Europe can move towards a lower carbon economy. There will be in a much clearer political way without the kind of arguments that are going on in the US right now. And that, in the end, will benefit the European economy because the European firms will get ahead of the technologies and the markets and so on as these develop around the rest of the world. And Europe looks at the future markets in China and India and other parts of the developing world and says, that's where the money's going to be made. It's going to be made in low carbon. So the sort of cross-party consensus that you get to a greater extent, not completely, but to a greater extent in Europe and other parts of the world, they would argue benefits their businesses and their economies.
Alistair Doyle, back to you, environment correspondent for Thomson Reuters. You said earlier that this had been on the back burner, the whole idea of climate change, for quite a while. People, you pointed out, weren't worried about polar bears anymore, but that there was a big surprise yesterday because so many people turned out in New York and elsewhere. But is this an issue that can go away pretty fast, particularly if there do appear to be economic issues? And can it become political in other places besides the United States?
I see. I suspect that it's the United States that's going to be the main political barrier, if you like. The differences there will keep other countries from acting because it's been in the United States. It's been like that way in the United States for quite a long time, in the sense that the rest of the world signed up to the Kyoto Protocol, among other developed countries. The Kyoto Protocol, which was, what some argue, a failed attempt to get countries to cut their greenhouse gas emissions. The European Union, even Australia at one time, Japan and Canada signed up for the Kyoto Protocol, but the United States never did. So it's really been the fault lines in the United States that have been the dominant issue here. I think that there are other countries that have run towards the door with the Kyoto Protocol, including Canada and Australia and Russia and Japan in recent times. What they've tried to do now, instead of sort of having a prescriptive approach, which is what the Kyoto Protocol does, the idea for Paris is that every country will come up with their own contribution, is what they're calling it, which means it's a much looser agreement. It'll be a sort of patchwork of national offers. The United States will say, we can do this. China will say, we think we can do that, and so on, or across all these countries, so that there won't be any sort of feeling of... there won't be a strong sort of centralized way of running it as there was with the Kyoto Protocol, which said you have to cut by this amount.
Quickly, Francis Beinecke, back to you. Final question, President of the Natural Resources Defense Council. How important do you think is this statement by Rockefeller Brothers Fund, given their history, to the politics of the United States? Do you think people will hear that who are now convinced that this is a bad idea rather than a good idea?
Well, I think it's one of the many steps that people are taking. I think the Rockefeller name is a very trusted name in the country, and the fact that they see a clean energy future as a mandate for this country will reverberate across the business sector and the philanthropic sector. So I think it's very important. And I also want to say that just these carbon pollution standards that we've been discussing clearly put the United States on a pathway for emission reductions that meet the U.S. commitment that the president made at Copenhagen. So we are moving very specifically forward in reducing our emissions and being able to provide that leadership which the world is demanding of us. So I think there is a pathway here, but it will only happen with a real concerted effort and with people around the country demanding that we do act.
And it is, as we heard, subject to politics as well. Frances Beinecke, thanks so much. You're president of the Natural Resources Defense Council. Thanks to Alistair Doyle, the environment correspondent for Thomson Reuters. Michael Jacobs, the senior advisor to the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate. And Ethan Zindler, the head of policy analysis at Bloomberg New Energy Finance. Great to have you all and come back and join us again. The Islamic State, ISIS or ISIL, has been called a threat to the U.S. homeland, but that's now said to be a distortion of what's actually happening in the Middle East. Intelligence officials have identified other groups emerging from the Syrian civil war that may be targeting the West even more directly. Back in a moment with To the Point.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Warren Olney back with today's Talking Point. Not much is known about Khorasan, but that's the name of a terrorist group identified by the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper Jr., who says, quote, in terms of a threat to the homeland, Khorasan may pose as much of a threat as the Islamic State. That's according to the New York Times in a story co-authored by Mark Mazzetti, and it's always good to have you on our program. Mark Mazzetti, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
Tell us more about Khorasan. What is it?
Well, we don't know a whole lot about it. It's only a group that we've only started hearing about in the last week. Clapper, as you said, mentioned it last Thursday during a question and answer. And best we can tell, it is a group that is made up of mostly Al-Qaeda operatives, what they say originally was core Al-Qaeda, which meant the group originally associated with Osama bin Laden living in Afghanistan and later in Pakistan, and that some of them have relocated to Syria. It is a group made up of operatives from across North Africa, Middle East, South Asia, and it is interesting in part because we've heard so much in the last several months about the rise of ISIS and the threat they pose, and in fact, President Obama has launched a military campaign against ISIS. But there's a difference here. Khorasan, it seems, is a more traditional terror group focused on terror attacks on the West and the United States, whereas ISIS is more of a group that's looking to consolidate territory, build up what it has declared as a caliphate. So it's just, I think it's important to just unpack what these groups are and what they're not and what their ultimate goals are.
You mentioned Al-Qaeda as part of the new group that we're just hearing about, Khorasan. But what about the al-Nusra Front? Isn't that Al-Qaeda? Aren't they endorsed by the current leader of Al-Qaeda?
Right. So, again, even with all the attention to ISIS, it's important to point out that ISIS has broken from Al-Qaeda, and the officially Al-Qaeda-designated group in Syria is the al-Nusra Front. It's our understanding that Khorasan is somehow an offshoot of Nusra or a splinter group from Nusra. But it's the Nusra ideology that is far closer to what bin Laden originally envisioned as opposed to ISIS. There was a big public break between ISIS and Nusra and Al-Qaeda earlier this year where Ayman Zawahiri, who's the head of Al-Qaeda, was bin Laden's successor and longtime number two, publicly broke off from ISIS because he did disagree with their tactics.
There's a real question, it seems to me, that skeptics need to hear asked, and that is this. When James Clapper Jr. says, in terms of the threat to the homeland, Khorasan may pose as much of a threat as the Islamic State, and that is, how much of a threat did the Islamic State really ever pose? And to what extent is there something that we ought to be worried about in this context, and to what extent is it being to some extent exaggerated in the interests of keeping people on edge?
Well, you know, we've written a few stories about this subject over the last month,
sure,
where we've tried to sort of give a reality check about ISIS to separate the rhetoric from the reality. And I think you're right. I think it's important where we try to say, okay, what does ISIS want to do? What it wants to do, it seems immediately, is build up, as I say, its governance, its caliphate in the Middle East. And the intelligence and law enforcement officials we talk to say there's no immediate plots that appear to be in the works by ISIS. They're not immediately focused on attacking the West. But yet we've seen this incredible amount of TV time devoted to ISIS and rhetoric from the administration and a decision by President Obama to attack them, that I think it's just important to point out. I think and especially because it came around the anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, people were starting to think this was a threat that was urgent and immediate. And so that's why we sort of to write some of the stories that we decided to do.
So how urgent then are the threats from Khorasan and al-Nusra? Do they have the resources to actually do something such as we saw on September 11th? Was that even in the case of al-Qaeda, a lucky break?
Sure. And, I think the people we've spoken to said that it still would be very hard for any group to carry off something akin to 9/11 today, given what's happened in the years since. At the same time, and so it's unclear whether if a group like Khorasan was trying to attack, they could attack American embassies overseas. They could attack inside Europe. It wouldn't necessarily have to be the 9/11-style attack that we all remember from so many years ago. And in terms of the capability, it's a good question. And I think that's what we're just learning about this group. We're just learning about the threat. And so we have to dig deeper to find out exactly what more we know about this group. And, I think to some degree, it's interesting that some of the same people who we thought, who we would talk to, who said that the ISIS threat in terms of its immediate urgency was slightly exaggerated, did express great concern about Khorasan/al-Nusra in terms of these are the people who at least have the desire to immediately attack the U.S.
When you said, as you did, that they report that they don't think ISIS has any immediate plot to attack the United States, it sounds as if they're inside ISIS and they know what people are thinking. Is that really true, or are they trying to figure this out based on what they have to observe from the outside?
I mean, I think that it's a little bit of both. I don't know of any big sources they have to penetrate ISIS. I think that when they usually say we have no credible evidence of a plot, it means that they're watching and they just don't think that there's anything necessarily in the works right now. Now, two things going on. They don't always say public what they know, and sometimes they say in public more than they actually know. So judging just from the public statements always isn't helpful.
All right. A tough job for you, Mark Mazzetti, a national security correspondent for The New York Times. Thanks so much for doing such a good job of it and helping us out. Also, I should mention, author of The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and A War at the Ends of the Earth. Good to have you on our program again.
Great to be back on.
I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.